30 dollars, 40 dollars, which is possible, then you made a much better choice than buying the cheap Chinese equipment. I would say it this way. Back to you.
Hey, but Frank, you can buy another one. As you guys are hearing, there's multiple opinions as to what is the right way to go. A digital meter that also measures inductance, capacitance, as well as resistance, a digital voltmeter, is one approach. Wesley is strongly of the opinion that a general radio 1658 impedance bridge, which you could only destroy it mechanically if you dropped it on the ground and bent up its dials. It is a thoroughly passive machine that, when properly used, this impedance bridge will allow you to measure with precision inductors, capacitors, and resistors, and the combinations of them. It is an impedance bridge. However, I think Mel's going to tell us that by the time you teach a beginner what the word impedance means, and reactance, and resistance, and susceptance, and conductance, that you're going to confuse the daylights out of them, you're going to scare them, and we're going a little too far too fast. That's an opinion. And each of these opinions are all valuable. You, the listener, have to decide which way you want to go. You want to take the high road or the low road, so to speak.
Do you think that they're going to learn faster when they see the digit on one digital meter? When they have a dial, it's much easier for them to understand more and have the hemorrhoid operators lift it to the higher level. I just don't understand that, what you think.
Too big, too complicated, too much to do to just go through your junk box and find out what the stuff is. Explaining how to use an impedance bridge. For a person with your background, Wesley, it sounds simple. You don't realize you're in the fifth state of knowledge. In other words, because you've used things like that for such a long period of time, you assume a large percentage of the population has that knowledge. You're going to be disappointed to find out that when you just mentioned the word phase shift and phase measurement, half the people within the sound of my voice have trouble understanding what that means. So for those reasons, I know Mel is trying to keep it quite simple, and each one of these guys starting out in electronics have to crawl first and walk later and run even later. That's, I think, Mel's attitude. So you're right for a certain kind of sophisticated person, Wesley. For some of these guys that are super beginners, it might be a little too much too fast, and we have differing opinions on that. Let me pass it back to Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WB2HWW.
You've got it, Mel.
Welcome to the W2VL repeater system.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yes, stop. I agree with Wesley. Let's start, say, with a simple instrument. This involvement of adding a capacitance instrument in an inductance, this is way past. We're nowhere near that now. We're talking about people, young people, they're preteens even, that are just starting out and they want to do little tiny experiments, as we would call DC. Just DC, hooking up switches, little light bulbs or whatever, or making a little simple circuit that they're going to be able to test it, maybe with working with a 1.5-volt or a 9-volt battery in a simple little circuit that they see, or putting together, a basic idea of what is going on. So a VOM is a simple instrument. Yes, it's nice to have these other instruments. I have all these little different little boxes and things that are sold so cheap, like Eric mentioned. But I've way past. In fact, we're just about like losing the audience. So I'm only going to say right now, let's leave it. Basically, we're starting out, and you're learning to taking your youngster, and they're learning to ride a two-wheeled bike. You don't go out and buy one of these 18-gear systems, Dick. And if you do, it's not for them to start messing with the gears until they learn how to balance on the bike. So just this is basically, we're starting out at the, just passing right now through taking the helper wheels off the bike, over.
Beautiful. S2N.
I agree with Mel.
WS2N.
Beijing,
Queen. Case Mel. KC2, Whiskey, Yankee, Queen. Your audio is extremely low, but nice, clean audio. Why don't you make a quick transmission, Mike? Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you. I have like no idea what you guys are talking about, but I do have a problem, and I'm trying to make sense out of all this. So can you guys go into a slower than explain some stuff?
Yeah, Mel is trying to slow us down a little bit so that we do give explanations as to how do you make voltage measurements and how do you make ohmmeter measurements and how would you test a battery with a voltmeter. We are discussing things like that. Let's see, who was it that's supposed to get it next?
S2N.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I wonder what Mel thinks about these little electronic kits that Radio Shack sold. I assume they still sell them. I mean, I bought one. But, you know, they have little resistors in there, and they have batteries to put in, and all these little string connectors, and you can make these little circuits. They give you a nice book. Oh, it's got to be 100 pages of different little experiments. You can do everything from a basic light to, you know, learning how a switch goes on to even making a little radio using a diode for a crystal, you know, place of a crystal though. But, you know, they have a little bit of everything. I wonder what Mel thinks about that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, are you familiar with those, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Yeah, there's several of them I've seen advertised. Very, very simple little thing to make, like a cold practice oscillator, one transistor oscillator, and things like that. But first, let them get started. Let them get, take the helping wheels off of the little two-wheeler and let them get their balance just by getting a BOM, sitting and seeing what you see when you put a resistor on, how you measure it, get used to the ranges, get used to be able to, like you say, even test the battery with on the volt ranges. I have a 1.5-volt battery. My daughter, Julie, when she was little, she was driving me crazy because she was always into all kinds of electronic gadgets and all. And like my wife says, she was a boy, I know what she would be doing. She would drive me crazy. Daddy, is this battery good? Is this little bulb or whatever is good? I got her a little BOM, and I taught her how to use, yeah, how you check. Now, make sure you put it on the right range. When in doubt, put it on the higher range. Work your way down so you don't bang the needle over. Things like that. She learned how, and to this day, she still does things in the house. She checks the outlet. She says, Dad, I still got the little BOM. I said, yeah. She says, still comes in handy. So, there you are. That is the basics of what, let me let it drop. This is the basics of where you start. You got to start very slow because otherwise the interest will be lost real quick. And Wesley is right because you can see actually with a VOM, an old-fashioned VOM, the ranges. You can see R times 1, R times 100. You can see the volt ranges. You can more or less get visually more what's going on than seeing something pop up digitally. As you alluded to earlier, Dick, with the cell phone, we know it works and everything. We literally don't know much about what's going on behind that little panel in there. And so that's the same thing. If you're going to get into the nitty-gritty, you've got to go very slow. And right now, they are at that point where the most basic piece, after hand tools and a little workbench, is the VOM. That's what I'll let it leave it at, Dick. Over.
A good voltmeter is probably the first instrument you want to own. I can't think of anything else other than a volt ohm milliammeter or a voltmeter you want to own. And if you want to know what it's doing, that meter movement on a Triplett or a Simpson or some of the other popular brands of analog volt ohm milliammeter is a 50 microampere movement. If you put a 50-volt battery across a 1 mega-ohm resistor, 50 volts and 1 mega-ohm, 50 microamperes would flow. That's Ohm's law. Voltage divided by ohms is current. So I've got a 1 mega-ohm resistor, a 50-volt power supply. I connect the 1 mega-ohm resistor across the 50-volt power supply. 50 microamperes will flow. 1 volt, by the way, on a 1 mega-ohm resistor, 1 microampere would flow. But I'm using a 50-volt battery for this particular example. A 50-volt battery, a 1 mega-ohm resistor across it, Ohm's law, 50 divided by a million, the answer is 50 microamperes would flow. When you put that voltmeter in the 50-volt full-scale reading, by rotating that great big dial on the front panel, you're putting a 1 mega-ohm resistor between the lead on the front panel and the meter, that's the thing on the front face that you're looking at. So as the 50 microamperes from your 50-volt battery flows through that 1 mega-ohm resistor, the meter will go all the way over to the right. Full scale is 50 microamps, because that's what those meters are, and you get full scale deflection. If the resistor is there, if the rotary switch is making contact, and if the meter is alive, that's the result you will get. Let me drop. And that's the way you measure voltage. It is some amount of current going through a meter. I've simplified things a little bit, because the 50 microampere meter movement has a little bit of resistance of its own. Let me pick a number and assume it had 1,000 ohms of resistance. Then for the meter to be accurate, it wouldn't be a 1 mega-ohm resistor. It would be a 999,000 ohm resistor. 1,000 ohms less than 1 million ohms would be that resistor for the meter to read accurately. But that's one of the fine details. But that's what's going on when you make a voltage measurement. When you make a 3-volt full-scale measurement, it's a lower resistor that's put in series with the meter. When you go to a higher voltage reading, it's a bigger resistor than 1 mega-ohm going in series with the meter. But that's what voltage measurement means on a volt-ohm milliammeter. Let me drop. When you're making an ohm meter measurement, there is an internal 1.5-volt battery on most of these volt-ohm milliammeters. And if the battery inside is not alive, for the most part, you cannot make an ohm-meter measurement. And what's going on in that case is that the 1.5-volt battery is put through a series resistor internally. It comes out to the two leads, and you put a unknown resistor across the leads on the outside that you want to measure, and it makes a certain deflection on that meter. One of the things that modern-day people forget about is that in the old days, on analog-type volt-ohm milliammeters, before you make an ohm-meter measurement, the very first thing you do is you choose what you think is the right scale. And if you choose the wrong scale when you're making an ohm-meter measurement, nothing bad happens. Either the needle moves too far to the left, or it doesn't move at all. Starts off to the right. Here we go. I got it backwards. Doesn't move, or it moves too easily, so to speak. But when you're making an ohm meter measurement, and as long as there's no voltage on the circuit that you're making a measurement, you're truly making an ohm measurement of an unknown device, the first thing you do is to short the two leads together, and there's a little wheel on one side where you adjust full-scale deflection. Every ohm meter measurement starts off with 0 ohms between the two leads because you've shorted the two leads together, and you twist that wheel until you get full-scale deflection. You want the needle to move all the way over to the other side when you do that. And you're adjusting for the fact that the internal 1.5-volt D-cell battery may be a little high or a little bit low in voltage today, or somebody may have twisted that wheel the last time they borrowed that meter from you. So you want to set full-scale deflection and make sure that it measures 0 ohms when you short the two leads together. Then you put them across the resistor that you're trying to measure the ohms of, or maybe a capacitor if you want to confirm that the capacitor is working correctly. So the first step is to first confirm, let me drop, that the ohm meter is working correctly and it is properly calibrated by shorting the two leads together. In the case of a digital voltmeter, you no longer have to do that. However, you skip that step of calibrating the ohm meter, so to speak, by shorting the two leads together, and you'd be amazed how much trouble you can get into. Modern day guys with a digital voltmeter, where they no longer have to do that, skip that step. They just connect the two leads across the resistor, and they believe whatever number of digital indication they get on the front panel of that meter. Because they never shorted the two leads together, the wire of their test probes could have a broken connection inside. They don't know about it. The meter itself may have had some kind of a failure. Without doing that very basic test of first connecting the two leads together and making sure it reads something very close to 0 ohms apparent, you skip that step and you're taking quite a bit of risk. The reading you get might not be telling you the truth, and you don't even have a clue. And that can lead you down a whole troubleshooting path that's a false alarm and you're chasing a red herring. I wonder how many people you've seen with modern digital voltmeters, Mel, who forget that step of shorting the two leads together before proceeding with the ohm meter measurement. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Let me tell you something. Funniest thing is, I was working at a bench in a place, had a couple of younger people around there, and I was doing some tests. And I doing some procedure, and I said, oh, this is good. And then one of them said to me, I didn't even see the needle really move. I says, I saw the way it's beginning the needle to move, that this test is okay. And this is because they've gotten used to, like you say, using a digital voltmeter. Many cases, I have still use my 260s. I got two of them on a bench. In fact, one I leave on the volt range. Usually, most of all the tests I need quick tests is around the 10 volts, on the 10 volt scale, you know, and most of the solid state, just looking for basically checking my 5 volts or whatever the heck, you know, so I can leave it that way. The other one I keep on the R scale, say, but as you mentioned earlier about switch failures, I've had a couple of them that I wore up constantly, rotating it around and around, that the switch begins to get play in it. And the problem is the detent is part of the case. It's molded in. In other words, these little spikes that stick up the detent, they're molded in, and they begin to wear out. It's, you know, it's made out of that old-fashioned Bakelite years ago. So what happens? Let me let it drop. The heater begins to get erratic. In fact, you're making a measurement, and you say, oh, boy, the voltage is low. You wiggle the knob a little bit, and the needle goes up. And you try tightening it up and things like that. It's only a limit to how much you can repair. And you can't replace many of those types, especially in triplet or Simpson. Because what they did is this molded assembly with that is the switching and all. Also got these resistors, the shunt and series resistors, all into this block. You know, or they made up this block and dropped this whole block right into the case and just hooked up to the, you know, the whole molded block contained for the battery, for like the D battery. You know, with the clips for the D battery in it, it's one molded blob like, and then it just hooked. They just hook up to the meter assembly, and you know, the probe contact assembly. But they're virtually, you know, go to the point where they're not really a usable instrument. So that's why I say that's one of the things. Some of them you go to turn, you feel the knob can almost swing around by itself, very little resistance in the detent. So that's why I could say, but Wesley even alluded to, let me, the best way to learn is to see the meter movement, to understand, you get used to that meter movement like you did and I did, that we know how we can check a power transformer or a capacitor, see it go. You can't do that with a digital meter. So the basic idea, again, I know we lost most likely, by 10:30 we lose all the young people, but the basically idea is here we are starting out at a very elementary point with the little bicycle, you remember with the help of wheels on? This is where we are right now. So that's why you got to have the help of wheels, and I think a VOF is the simplest electronic test instrument, and to start visualizing what's happening, Dick, over.
I agree with Mel.
Yeah, so do I. Mel, if I go to a flea market and I find a volt-ohm milliammeter for sale, and I twist the big rotary dial, and I confirm that the detents feel correct, that those haven't been worn down. If now, as I go to each one of the voltage ranges and each one of the ohm-meter ranges, I feel a distinct click, and it clicks into the right position. Once the meter movement on that great big rotary dial on the front panel, once the volt-ohm milliammeter passes that test, am I then most likely in good shape as far as all of the rest of the internal contacts of that big rotary dial probably being okay, particularly after we've done the 9-volt battery test, the 1.5-volt battery test, the 1-kilo-ohm test, the 10-kilo-ohm test, and so on. Once I've done a couple of those tests and I feel real good detents on that main rotary dial, am I then 95% assured that the rest of the mechanical meter of the rotary dial is probably in workable order or fixable order? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, yeah, listen, if it goes through the volt, the whole range that's usually on the left side of the knob, is the voltage is starting at 2.5 and working your way up. The other side, the R times 1. Of course, you got the milliamp, they got the milliamp shunt in there, the resistance for the read milliamps, R times 1. What do they have? 1 milliamp? I think a 1 milliamp that some of them had, full scale. Yeah, some had microamps, went down to the microamp scale. Then they had a 10 milliamp. Some of them had that you can switch the probes, like on Simpson, where you can make it, put it on 10 amp scale, make the scale, you put it on R times, no, you put it on volt, 50 volt range, and then you can read on that range, you can read the, I forgot how many amps on the scale. They got a whole bunch of different arrangements. But the idea is you want to substantiate basically the voltage ranges and the resistance ranges are working, and the needle isn't physically, In other words, it's not a beat-up instrument. Some of them, have made a lot of trips to the floor. So they're basically pieces of junk, the needle will get stuck. That's another thing. Let me let it drop. What happens sometimes to a VOM, because the needle's been swung around back and forth too much, abused the meter, that when you see the needle move up and you take your battery, let's say you put it on 10 volts, and the needle is going to move up, say, to 9 volts, and when you take the battery away, the needle doesn't drop down. You tap the instrument, it drops down. That meter is no good. Forget it. No good no more. And the same thing if you go to, like Dick says, the R times 1 or the R times 10, you put the probes together and you zero it. There's a knob that says zero. That means you adjust it to when the needle is all the way over, you zero it. And then you take the probes apart and the needle stays up there. And you tap the instrument and it drops down. You dip that instrument. It's no good to meter. The needle itself is... The instrument looks fairly decent shape. You can take a chance on it, especially if it's reasonably priced. And nothing like having an old, something like a Simpson 260, Dick. I find it, after all these years, still a marvelous instrument, over.
It sure is. And a sticking needle can be very troublesome. If you ever make the mistake of taking apart the meter movement itself, which I recommend you do not do, but if you ever take apart the meter movement itself because you think you want to adjust something internally, you've got to be super careful that you're in an extremely clean environment. The tiniest piece of a whisker of steel wool that gets into that magnet of that meter movement will give you a sticking needle, and that can be very troublesome. So do look for that. When you're doing the voltmeter measurements, make sure the needle itself moves smoothly and doesn't move in jerks, and you have to tap on it to bring it back down to zero. I won't say that it's useless, but it's very annoying to have a meter that works that way, and I've had one that did that. Before we lose the crowd that has to go to bed at 10:30, and some of these guys are very interested in space, let's see what Paul's got to say, what's going on. I know that the space shuttle is now at the International Space Station, WS2N, K2RIW on TechNet. You've got it, Paul.
Okay, now, well, we pretty much covered the space portion of the net, the STS-132 with the docking of the space station, of course, going overhead tonight. So that was great. I really didn't have much. You know, we could look forward to future missions. Like you said before, unmanned missions are going to be the most popular. You've got the Juno flight coming up for Jupiter to replace the Galileo flight, which was very popular years ago. That's going to orbit some of the moons around Jupiter. You know, interesting ones that have already left the launch pad. Messenger is in another year will be orbiting Mercury. So these are future missions we'll cover on the net when they come up. By the way, Opportunity and Spirit, let me drop it. They're up to, this is over 6 years. They landed 2004. January 3rd and January 14th, Spirit and then Opportunity, respectively. So here we are, 2010. They're up to over 6 years now, Dick. So, and Spirit is kind of stuck in the sand. They're getting measurements off of it before the winter. But now they're in the middle of the winter. They hope after the Mars winter that thing comes back to life again. So we'll have to wait and see. It survived a couple of winters already. But it's more or less went into a safe mode. The power went so low in Spirit that it's trying to just use whatever power it has to keep it its internal electronics heated. So much for that. And that's pretty much it. Let me drop it. Main thing I was going to mention was STS-132, so we covered that in the beginning of the net. Wanted to thank Mel, nothing to do with the space net, but Mel's idea with the light for putting in place of a fuse to make a lot of different tests in a circuit board is a great idea. I did that and put electrical tape around it and all, so I don't electrocute myself and use a 150-watt light bulb and put it inside of a power supply for a TV. Made a lot of tests and determined, in fact, there's so many tests, I took the power supply out of the TV and it's still lighting up like Broadway, so the short is still in that board. So the only way I think I'll probably find a solution for that problem is to get a new board, because it's like literally 100 components on one side and probably about 30 or 40 surface mounting components on the other. So there you go. But that's a great idea with light to replace a fuse, to duplicate a short circuit until the light goes out. Back to you, Dick. WS to it.
Yeah, it seems like it was 1 or 2 weeks ago that you were troubleshooting your high-definition solid-state television, which had a 3-ampere fuse and a mysterious green object that looks like a bolo resistor, a soft start resistor that was in series with a 3-ampere fuse. And so either on the 110-volt plug on the hot side, you put the 150-watt light bulb as a soft starting device and as a current limiting device, or you put it in series, you put it in place of the 3-ampere fuse. In either case, you're getting the same amount of protection. And since the light bulb is lighting up full brilliance, it means that your circuit is acting like a short circuit. And we're pretty sure it should not. The next thing you could do, Paul, before you just simply replace that power supply, if the power supply is, let me drop, if it's an inexpensive item, just buying another one and replacing that as a module, that's one approach. However, many amateurs would take pride in going the next step, and that is to put their ohm meter across each one of the electrolytic capacitors and confirm that they're not a short circuit. Or there's various ways you can test the bridge rectifying diode assembly to make sure that it doesn't have a mysterious short circuit, and so on. So there are ways that you can do the next step, Paul, even though they are surface mount components, and there's a whole lot of them on that power supply, even though you've disconnected the power supply from the rest of the television set, and you're just firing it up independently, and it still lights the 150-watt current-limiting light bulb that you've got in series, and therefore your power supply is still, from the 110-volt line point of view, acting like a short circuit. There's quite a few other tests you can do, Paul, and in the process of doing that troubleshooting, even though you don't have the schematic, but I'll bet you there's a way you can get the schematic. There's probably a part number on that printed circuit board. The whole television set itself has a part number. In the old days, there used to be something called SAMS PhotoFacts schematic diagrams for almost every piece of appliance that you and I could buy. By one way or another, I think you can get the schematic. Let me turn it back to you, Paul, for comments on
Clint.
For comments on any of the above. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, well, I can probably get the schematic, but like I said, hundreds of components on one side and surface mounted things and chips on the other on a power supply board, switching power supply, it's going to be a problem. My next step is to read up and study up on switching power supplies, the theories behind them and how they work. And I have a rough idea, but by the way, when I read it, there is no bridge rectifier system that I could figure out with the switching power supplies. I know with the regular one, regular power supply, you have a transformer, bridge rectifier, you have full wave, half wave, depending on whatever it is, and then you go to a filter network. I don't see any of that. I mean, there's diodes all over everywhere, I checked there's a lot of capacitors. I did check that there was one big 300 microfarad capacitor. I checked that's good. I know how to check that with a meter. So I can watch the meter move and all as it charges up, and everything seems to be good as far as that goes. Let me drop it 1 second. I had the question. I thought that one component that was maybe it was an MOB. It was green, but Mel came out with some mister. Yeah, that's what it was. And I checked that. That's no problem with that. That's good. That's close to be in line. That's in series. Mel says, take the board out. Yeah, gotta have to take the board out. So I did that and checked the circuit board where all these connections go. And that green connection is in line in series with the neutral on the board. And then beyond that, I didn't see it until I removed another metal piece of cover that was over it. And an MOB did show up, and that was that's definitely an MOB. As you could tell, not only by looking at it, but on the board itself, there's a schematic drawing for each individual component. If it's a resistor, it looks like a resistor. So it's really good, and I unsoldered that. Maybe that's shorted. Unsoldered the one lead, turned it on, and sure enough, the light is still lit. So it's further down the road. But and then it goes into a toroid coil. That's the next thing down line. So I don't know why it goes into that. Maybe that's some kind of a filter, RF filter. Why it goes into a toroid after this whole series of connections, I don't know. We'll see. We'll, yeah, I'm going to do that, Dick. Track it down. The new board is probably about 100 and a half. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
WHCDL, I've got a question.
Yeah, 100 and a half is a little bit pricey, and I don't blame you for being reluctant to just simply go and buy another one of those on a television set that maybe is only worth twice that number of dollars. Once you know the brand name and model number, Andy, do you know of a way that he can get a schematic diagram of that power supply to B2CDL, K2RIW?
That's a good question. Is this a TV? I just have a basic question. Is this a switching power supply for a TV?
That's our best guess. This is that circuit that he brought to our attention 1 or 2 weeks ago. It had the mysterious green object in series with the 3-ampere fuse, and the 3-ampere fuse blows immediately. At first he was suspicious of the mysterious green object, which we think is a soft stock resistor, a thermistor. But he's now used a 150-watt light bulb where the fuse used to be, and the bulb lights up continuously, which means he just would have blown another fuse if he puts one in there. So the power supply is acting like a short circuit. It's a switching power supply. So far, he's confirmed that the obvious filter capacitors are not as short. He hasn't found a rectifying network, although he's seen a lot of diodes. And that toroid that you see, Paul, quite possibly is the inductor that's part of the switching regulator. And when it gets back to you, you're going to tell us whether or not that toroid has one winding on it or more than one winding. If it's got more than one winding, quite often there are different colors, and you'll see multiple leads coming out of it, more than just two leads. Andy, I know you wanted to ask a question, but yes, this is a high-definition solid-state television that he is troubleshooting because it blows 3-ampere fuses. WA2CDL, K2RIW.
Isn't that he's always in the first winding when he put the light bulb in it? So the rest doesn't matter. It's just that the circuit is open, and the only load is the bulb, and so it's there.
Now, he's got the light bulb in series with the circuit. So the circuit from the 110-volt line is acting like a dead short because the bulb is giving him full brilliance.
He's not doing anything to that. He's still in the first winding. He's shorting the circuit with the 110 volts that it's coming into. So whatever is happening after that with the power supply doesn't matter. Back to you.
Okay, you and I have a difference of opinion on that one. With a 3-ampere fuse, most likely that that power supply should never draw more than 1 ampere when it's under the full load of the television set. He's now got it disconnected from the television set. It should only be drawing a few milliamperes. It should never light up a series 150-watt light bulb, which is looking for 1.5 amperes. So he is indicating a fault, in my opinion. Andy, you had a suggestion. WA2CDL, K2RIW.
Yeah, just I'm curious. Is the switching transistor shorted? That'd be the first thing that I would look for. And I have a test set that's made by Sencor that analyzes horizontal output transistors for TVs. And if your horizontal output blows, but what I did was I redesigned it to incorporate that into any switching power supply. To substitute, it actually will substitute the switching transistor with 1/10 the voltage. And then you can troubleshoot it from there, and it works very well. That was my own idea. But I was just curious if the... and of course, you know that you got to use an isolation transformer because if you're rectifying the line voltage... one side, there's two grounds. There's line ground and there's, of course, the power supply ground, and they're isolated from each other. You've got to make sure that if you put a scope probe on it, you're not going to put the scope probe ground to the negative side of the bridge rectifier. So you got to isolate that, and that also Sencor has an isolation transformer that actually measures the current and shuts back if the current is adjustable. You can adjust the current from zero current up to, 6 or 7 amps of current, and it's adjustable. The trip set is adjustable, so if you're drawing too much, it'll shut back. Another handy device, which I have. I was using all this stuff for troubleshooting computer monitors because I was in the business of repairing computer monitors, and I use switching power supplies. That's why I'm asking if the switching transistor is shorted, because a lot of times it would be, and then you're going to draw a lot of current. Back to you, Dick.
That was a quadruple, and I got nothing out of it. He hasn't yet identified which is the switching transistor, and with all of those components as a surface mount, he hasn't removed what might be the switching transistor to do that test yet, Andy. And what's the probability, in your opinion, that he could measure whether or not the switching transistor is a dead short when it's in the circuit? I'm a little bit skeptical about that one, particularly if it's a depletion mode transistor. It would act as a short circuit when it's not fired up. Only the enhancement mode type of switching transistor would be an open circuit, not fired up, and then become a short circuit when it's fired up. W2CDL, K2RIW.
K2KEY, I know what trouble is.
And to exam.
Okay, we're going to go to Andy, Mel, and Wesley, in that order, and then MDP after that. Andy first, go ahead.
All right, good evening to everybody. Well, I'm curious, what kind of transistor is it? Is it an FET or is it a bipolar? That's the first thing. And now I'm trying to think what else. If he hasn't gotten to that transistor, it's... I wouldn't think it's a service-mount transistor. It would be something that dissipates a little bit more power than a service mount. If it's the main switching transistor, and it's very easy to find it because that would go in series with the transformer, the switching transformer that it's driving. I'm assuming there's a transformer in this thing, which is a step down or step up to the voltages that are, of course, rectified on the secondary of the transformer. So that transformer has to be in series with the switching transistor in order for the transformer to operate at the frequency that it's operating in the first place. So you can trace that out just by looking at the lens. That's what I do, even without a schematic. And then by looking at the transistor, once you identify it and looking at the transistor number, you can figure out if it's a bipolar FET or what have you. So that's very easy as a visual inspection. That's what I do, without schematics. I just thought I'd throw that in. I have to sign now, but if you need any help, I can help you with that. I've troubleshot so many of those things over the years. And with the Sencor thing that I have, it pinpoints it right off the bat. It makes it so quick, I don't have to waste a lot of time, Paul. So let me know. Email me if you want. Stick back to you and I'll see you later. Don't need to see you.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you very much. By the way, you're way advanced, way more advanced than you think I am. Back to you, Dick.
CC2, QIQ. We got a whole lot of people lining up here for this one. Andy, if Paul was willing to walk over to your QTH with that power supply, would that be a possible mode of troubleshooting? W2CDL, K2RIW.
Yeah, I could very easily point it out what the problem is without a schematic. You don't even need a schematic for it.
Okay, so that's a possible way that Paul can go. Mel thinks he knows what it is. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is Kate. I'm going to ask Paul one question, and then I'll tell you the whole story, because when he said modular power supply in a television set, I think I know which one it is. Paul, is it a Mitsubishi MGA?
No. It's a Hewlett Packard, HP. No, not Mitsubishi. I was surprised at this. This is, HP makes good stuff, computers and all. And this looks like it has missing components in the power supply board. I don't know if that's common. they might have reverse engineered things. I mean, there's capacitance, you know, they have like a little diagram for a capacitor and two holes. And there's nothing in there. I see a couple of diodes here and there. So they you know, I remember Dick mentioned years ago that companies would spend money on removing components to see if the thing would still work. You know, maybe that's the case here. Maybe they used to have more components and they disappeared, you know, over time. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the first thing that crossed my mind. Where are these three or four components that are here that were never put in? You know, did they change their mind in the middle of the manufacturing? No, it's not Mitsubishi. Now back to you.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right, now, Hewlett Packard, okay, I know which one that is also. The, that power supply, no, how it happened a few years ago, they had more components because as they simplified or made the integrated circuits and the other parts more, in other words, they came up with ICs and things that reduced the surface-mounted components. In other words, this is the whole secret today. Reduced amount of components, separate components on a board. So what they did is to salvage the board, they most likely had a tremendous run on the board. As they were able to simplify the boards with less components, they just kept using the boards and just left out those components. Some of the boards you look at, half the components are missing. You can see all the prints and everything on there and, you know, numbers and all, but nothing there. So it's a common situation. But that power supply, you know how that has a transformer on it that looks like a, well, it works like a flyback circuit, actually. It's got an oscillator. It converts the voltage that's coming in, 110 volts. It's got that filter capacitor and all, and then it goes into the oscillator, which drives the transformer. Let me let it drop. And it has transistors. Now, some of them had bipolarizer. That's why I know I'm familiar with the Mitsubishi has the same setup. They have multi-transistors on the output, depending on how hefty a power supply is. But the rule of thumb is, when you blow the first fuse on those, when that 3-amp blew, there may have been one component there. When you put the second 3-amp fuse in, you added more burned-out components. It starts to go down the chain. And the more fuse times you blow fuses, the more components many times are destroyed. So check with them and see what a power supply is. Maybe your cheapest way out, because I'll tell you another thing. If you were to find a component there in the board, let's say the transformer there on that board, you're not going to get it. They do not supply individual components anymore for that. So you can get the schematic. You'll see a block diagram of the power supply. And just like they usually say now on like tuners, IF strips and all, any of these you know, devices that are modular, that they just say replace as by this part number, by the part number. Do not call them, because I've had this experience. And they say, I picked out this part on the board, R number or U number or something. They will not supply it, Paul. You're wasting your time, over.
No wonder nobody wants to fix this stuff. I tried that, Mel. You're right.
Now, the main switching transistor, because it's a significant dissipation device, my guess is it is not surface-mounted to the board. The three leads from the transistor probably go into the board, but that component is probably standing up and may be connected to a heatsink. Is that possible, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly, sure. The power transistor is definitely on the heatsink. Now, if that power transistor is bad, let's say you take it off the board and it's bad, you release it, and you have put a number of fuses in and kept blowing them, you have made D, and usually it's a good case, that you draw excessive current through the transformer, that transistor is in, like Andy described. It's basically, picture a flyback, an old conventional flyback circuit. That's how these switching power supplies work. Simply, very similar to an old flyback circuit. So, what used to happen, you remember, we want to go back to the tube days. If you had a tube in the many times, a failure of the horizontal output tube dragged the killed the flyback winding deck over.
Enter XJN for the moment.
In his case, the so-called transformer is a toroid. I don't think he can blow that toroid, Mel. Paul, that toroid that you see, does it contain more than one winding? WS2N, K2RIW?
That's the snippet.
Yeah, okay, do I, let me see if I have it. Yeah, no, that's, it looks like it's just one winding. I checked the printed circuit board. It looks like one winding. I'm making diagrams of it as, you know, little by little, and that's pretty much all I got up to. There is, I think, two transformers on that board, and there are outputs of, I think, 5 volts. It's actually two different 5-volt outputs, DC. And then there's a 12-volt output, and let's see. I forgot. I wrote it down. Another one, not too high. I don't know. There's at least three different voltage levels that come out of this board. So, yeah, okay. I'll look for the... There is a regular transformer in there, and I'll look to see what feeds that. Because there's probably at least nine, maybe ten things. I'll call them transistors. I mean, they could be silicone. They could be SCRs. You know, they could be anything. But there's at least probably 9, maybe 10 of these things mounted to aluminum heat sinks. You know, each one has 3 wires coming out of it. And, they're not identical. You know, it's not like, you know, they're all, you know, everything looks different and, you know, different numbers on each one. So I'll just look for the one that goes to the first transformer that I see. And I guess I have to remove it to test it, and then once it's out, I'd have to test it. So, I don't know, maybe I'll email Andy back to you that Dick.
I'll tell him the chokes are the transformer, Dick. I know exactly what he's talking about. You got a driver transformer, which drives the output, the driver, the transistor, which drives this transformer, and it's the choke that you're talking about, Dick, that is called a snippet choke.
Wow.
I know it's one of these damping assemblies. As I see it, Paul, if you walk that circuit board over to Andy's QTH, I think there's a 95% chance it'll be fixed in about 15 minutes. I wonder if you're willing to do that, Paul. Make an arrangement with Andy and walk it over there. WS2N, K2RIW.
I know where to get the schematic.
I that's good, but I'll listen to that. But I'll email Andy before I start taking transistors off of this thing. I mean, I have a diode checker, but you know, there's the base, the gate, three different connections. You know, I'll have to check which one is which, and I wouldn't know if it was good anyway, Dick. So that's what I was telling Andy. You know, you're way out there. He's way ahead of me. It's funny, you know, it brings back the beginning part of the net. There's different levels that people listen to, beginner, middle, and you know, I'm somewhere above the, somewhere in the middle, below the middle, I would say. So you're dealing with all kinds of levels here, Dick. Back to you.
So we haven't heard from Glenn. KCQQIQ, if you were in this situation, what would you do, Glenn? KCQQIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening to everybody on the net. I think in this particular case, my first idea would be to try to look for another replacement board if you could get it. I think because the amount of test equipment and what's really required here, the success rate here isn't going to be too good. I think what Andy said initially is probably on the money. There is a switching device, whether it's the main switch in a flyback, a boost rectifier that's failed, you know, something inside a major power component that goes across the line is definitely shorted out. You know, technically you could find it, replace the power part, and you still might have a problem because whatever drives those switching parts, the controller ICs or the drivers, they could also be failed. So there may be a whole chain of parts that have to be replaced, And unless you really are experienced with knowing what the waveforms look like and what they're supposed to be and then bringing it up slowly, I think if you do find the parts and just replace the power parts, that may not be enough to K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You did, guy wanted to say exactly the same.
Yeah, I can tell that the level of repair and troubleshooting required is considerably beyond simple. Switching power supplies can be fairly elaborate. My son is taking graduate level courses at a college right now on switching type power supplies, and boy, there's lots of kinds of them. However, for a replacement of this power supply of $150, that's a little bit on the pricey side. I can see why Paul would be a little reluctant to do that. One quick walk of that over to Andy's house, where Andy has all of the parts. He's already got the test circuit that he has used when he repairs circuits very similar to this on cathode ray tube monitors. He's got the circuit that will substitute for the FET transistor, and he can test it in circuit or substitute it. And as I said, he's got the parts. There's a 90% chance he can fix it, or at least find out if it's worth trying to fix. The person who said, you know, where to get a schematic for a Hewlett-Packard high-definition television, who were you and where would he go? Started with your name and your call letter, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
This is Lou. My call sign is KC2VR. And actually, I used to fix TVs. And I always got my schematics from at a library, and they're absolutely great.
Okay, that was Lou, KC2BFR. Little audio is a little bit low, Lou. So East Meadow Library carries all of the schematics for many brands of high-definition television, including Hewlett-Packard. Is that what you're saying, Lou? East Meadow Library. Go ahead, Lou.
Well, you know, I don't know how up-to-date they are because I haven't been fixing TVs lately, but I always got my schematics there, and there's no charge, but you don't take them with you. What you do is you photocopy them. They have a million photocopy machines there, and it came in quite handy. I saved a bundle of money with that service.
2KEY, I got a comment on that.
Hi, go ahead, Mel.
Nope. Manufacturers do not supply those schematics anymore. You get the, they'll give you a layout of what they call a wiring system. In other words, you look at an IC. When you look at an integrated circuit anywhere in a manual or whatever it is, they don't show you the internal wiring of that integrated circuit. The same thing with these modules. They do not break it down as to part level anymore. They show you on the schematic, you'll see a square with numbers, the pin numbers that it first, and it's routing from one module to the other. Those days are gone when they used to have schematics, because I ran into that situation just recently. I wanted a schematic of the video board, that is in a computer that drives a monitor. In other words, that card, the video card, and you cannot. We tried a number of different ways. For a certain way, we want to do some kind of adaption. We had an idea, and I just wanted that on that card that drives the monitor. That's a separate, board module in there. I want the schematic of that, just the pinouts of everything. Cannot get it, Dick. Over.
I beg to differ.
Blue. Actually, you don't get the manufacturer's schematic. What they do have is Sam's Photo Facts. They carry a complete line of Sam's Photo Facts from the first copy all the way up to wherever they are now. Over.
That's good information, Lou. I think I heard Eric say he knows where to get schematics. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Photo Facts, the business.
Yeah, well, it depends on the manufacturer. Sony is very good. Of course, you have to buy their service manual. And usually in the schematic itself, they show you the block and the pinout, but usually somewhere they actually show you all the chips and what's inside of it. Sony's good like that. Hitachi's good like that. Toshiba's good like that. There's some others that the Chinese, Samsung, if you buy the Samsung schematic, there's a auxiliary book that you buy that has the actual circuitry or at least the logic of what's inside the chips in a separate book.
Yeah.
Hewlett-Packard.
This is Hewlett-Packard brand name, Eric. What's the chances?